You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Freddie.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I cannot complain.
So this is the first time you and I have ever done a Blogging Heads together.
This is true.
You know, it's a bit of trivia I bet you don't know, which is that when you first instituted comments on Blogging Heads, when you first like attached a comment forum there, I was the first person ever to have a comment deleted. So, and by you, actually.
Congratulations. You know, our standards for deletion were pretty loose then, so you must have said something truly objectionable.
I think it might have had to do with the appearance of a Blogging Heads regular.
We do discourage, with all due respect to the contribution you were making to Western civilization by pointing out that someone on Blogging Heads was unattractive, we do discourage that kind
of thing. Well, it wasn't that mean, but anyway, we'll let it slide off into history. Okay. That was in my youth.
Let me quickly introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show. You are Freddie DeBoer. And it's funny. I mean, we're going to talk about a number of things today. We're going to talk about the alt-left, of which you are allegedly a member. We're going to talk about a lot of Trump-related stuff, of course. And we're going to eventually get into the question of IQ. A question you had for me about IQ is what led to this conversation, actually. So we'll back into that and eventually get into whether IQ has any validity as a concept. But first, as long as you're talking about comments, and as long as I want to get into, like, your position on the ideological spectrum, I think you're an interesting specimen, both because of where you are on the ideological spectrum, and because I think, you know, you are now part of the public conversation, and I think you're someone who 30 years ago might well have never become part of the public conversation. And if I recall correctly, did you first rise to prominence by being a renegade commenter on Matt Iglesias's blog?
Oh, a few blogs, yeah. So it was Matt Iglesias and like Megan McArdle and Ross Douthat, back when he used to have one at The Atlantic.
Matt denounced you though, right?
Many times. Although I guess for context, Iglesias had a regular kind of commenting core, a group of people that commented on his blog over the course of many years and many different iterations, because he was constantly moving from one URL to another, from one publication to another. And we had this sort of commenting core, which was sort of generally supportive but critically engaged with him. And the thing is that his politics changed a lot. He moved in a much more kind of neoliberal direction from where he had been originally. And we sort of represented this sort of slow evolution of his ideologically. We sort of tracked it, and then we all gave up when he went to Slate, both because Slate's comments are impossible to use, and also because that was sort of like the last straw in his sort of. I mean, I said at the time that he had gotten the Mickey Kouse endowed chair in neoliberal studies at Slate. So
I'd say you're blurring a line or two there, but
probably.
With all due respect to both of them, but the point is, you know, you emerged at a, you know, from the grassroots, so to speak, in a way that wasn't possible before the internet, right?
Sure.
You didn't go through any credentialing process. Right. You didn't get a job somewhere that entitled you to demand that we listen to you, as used to be the case.
Right. Yeah. And now, I mean, and I've since written for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post and the Guardian and Harper's and N+1 and, you know, Politico and Playboy and the New Republic. And, and that's for all my cynicism about the modern media landscape, the fact that I have been able to do that says something good about how things have changed.
In your humble opinion.
Well, I mean,
the emergence of Freddie DeBoer is a good thing. Okay?
The emergence of, I mean, I literally started my blog, my old blog, a couple blog iterations ago, at a public library on a computer there, because I had dropped out of school and didn't have anything going on in my life and was just looking for some sort of a project to do. And the fact that I could be sitting at a public computer at the library and start a blog and, you know, within a few months of doing it, be communicating with people at the New York Times or the Atlantic or places like that. For all of the many reasons to be cynical about the internet, that was one of the things that was truly transformative about it.
Mm-hmm. And so now, anyway, you actually do have a respectable job. What's mm-hmm. your respectable job?
I'm an administrator at Brooklyn College, where I work with accreditation and student assessment.
Mm-hmm. And you had done graduate work in what, where?
So I got my master's degree at the University of Rhode Island, and my PhD at Purdue University, which I finished a couple of years ago, in writing assessment, in educational assessment, educational evaluation, stuff mm-hmm. like that. Okay. Most of my day-to-day life involves things like standardized testing and things like that.
Okay. So let's talk about this alt-left thing. Now, the last person I talked to on Blogging Heads who was allegedly a member of the alt-left was Michael Tracy. And I've mm-hmm. noticed that you two do get denounced by the same people on Twitter. So you must have something in common. And I should say, by way of background, the alt-left, this is a piece that James Walcott wrote for Vanity Fair, declaring there to be such a thing as the alt-left, and saying, and declaring it, I think, to be a pernicious thing in his view, right? And the only, like, what's wrong with this picture thing was that he said Mickey Kaus was part of it, which we all agree, including Mickey, makes no sense whatsoever. But aside from that, like you, Michael Tracy, some other people, I think there is kind of a there. There's some kind of coherence. And it's not what the other kids are doing. And you can tell because the other kids are denouncing you. Mm. So what is it that you get denounced for on Twitter that you think is maybe characteristic of something that you people have in common?
Well, I think that, I mean, the basis, I mean, I don't use the term the alt-left.
Right.
There is definitely an insurgent left, I think. There is a widespread dissatisfaction with not just the Democratic Party, but also with mainstream liberalism, mainstream progressivism that's coming from the left. In some senses, that's sort of traditionally sort of a left liberal divide in terms of like extremity. So that piece mentioned Jacobin Magazine, which is a socialist journal, in which I've been published many times and many of my friends are involved with. But it's not just about extremity. It's also about a really palpable sense of frustration and exhaustion with the sort of traditional edifice of modern American liberalism. And there's a sense that that establishment liberalism has failed, that it has fallen asleep at the wheel, that it has gotten too cozy in the halls of power. And that there is a sense of sort of a collusion with these major liberal enterprises that resulted in a lot of capitulation to the right. All of that is sort of exemplified by the Bill Clinton administration, where you had things like the welfare reform bill, which tripled extreme poverty in this country.
Which Mickey Kaus championed, so right away you know he probably doesn't belong in the
alt-left. Mickey's inclusion is very weird in that piece.
I think it was a personal thing between James Walcott and him or something. I don't know.
Right. Also, the Clinton administration, I think, like the Clinton crime bill, which was just really epitomized the war on Black America.
Well, you didn't want to get rid of super predators, Freddie?
Yeah, well, that's exactly it, right? Like, you know, that someone could talk about super predators, that Bill Clinton literally, when that bill was signed, was standing in front of a row of Black prisoners behind him. There's an amazing photo you can find if you look for it. We feel that that problem was allowed to sort of persist without a very vocal opposition because institutions like the New Republic, institutions like, I mean, this is much newer, but things like the Center for American Progress, right, which is a much newer invention, but which represent this kind of genteel establishmentarianism, establishmentarian liberalism that is far too willing to sort of concede points to the right that it shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And what we want is a vocal and sometimes angry left-wing alternative that's willing to make an unapologetically left-wing sort of argument. In terms of why I'm denounced, I mean, I'm kind of an asshole. I guess that's probably one thing that is important to put out there.
Thanks for clearing that up.
Yeah, but there is a – we tend to have a certain style, which is disdainful of a lot of this, what I would call the signaling functions of modern progressivism or modern liberalism. You are supposed to sort of embed everything that you say, particularly if you're a straight white dude like me, in a kind of tone of apology or with a lot of sort of qualifications and provisos that I don't particularly like to do because I think that that's juvenile and it doesn't actually change anything. And so I think that's part of the denunciation. But I also think a lot of it is just liberals have been accused of being socialists and radicals and Marxists and crazy lefties by conservatives for so long that it's very destabilizing for them to be then accused of other things from the left. And they've gotten used to this situation where conservatives have so lost sight of the basic sort of breadth of the ideological spectrum that it's very weird for them, hurtful for them to be attacked from their left.
Okay, so let's pause on this issue of like white privilege. I take it like you don't want to spend a lot of time acknowledging and apologizing for your white privilege.
Well, I acknowledge it, right? Like I will totally acknowledge it. Let everybody at home listening to this. I have absolutely never denied the existence of white supremacy. I've never denied the existence of white privilege. I've never denied the existence of my white privilege. We are in a hideously racist society that's set up to favor the interests of white people like me. We're in a patriarchal society that's set up to favor the interests of men like me. We're in a homophobic society, et cetera, et cetera. I will absolutely acknowledge all of that, and I think that we need a muscular response to solving it. My issue is that if I get on here and I do this dance, right, and I laboriously sort of say, as a privileged white man, as someone who exemplifies the patriarchy, even if I don't want to, if I go through all these apologetics and these signals, I'm doing that for me, right, and not to materially address the problem, right? I can acknowledge my white privilege until I'm blue in the face. It doesn't make any difference, right? Precisely because racism is a durable institution. The problem with things like with a lot of privilege politics is it centers the individual and your sort of discursive, apologetic form of communication. But as a Marxist, right, I believe that these problems are structural in their nature and they can only be attacked by, at the level of the structure.
So you are not motivated by a concern you hear in the age of Trump, I gather, which is that Trumpism, which I think we all agree, I mean, I think everyone on the left kind of agrees Trumpism is in some sense the enemy or an enemy, but you're not motivated by the concern that identity politics has fueled Trumpism, that part of the support for Trump is a reaction against identity politics.
I wouldn't put it that way. So I tend to try to avoid the term identity politics, and I try to avoid the term political correctness because I think that both obscure more than they actually clarify. I don't think that identity politics has enabled the rise of Trump in the sense that, of course, we have to pay attention to racism, to sexism, to homophobia, to ableism, things like that. The issue is that the Democratic Party in particular has used those issues as a screen to obscure their refusal to adopt economic policies that could have helped to defeat Donald Trump. There was a war in left of center spaces during the Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton campaign, the primary. And that war took on a lot of different fronts, but it was essentially about what's the future of the left of center party going to be in this country. And you have people like Cory Booker, who is a rising star of the Democratic Party, a black senator from New Jersey, who says things like, don't demonize Jeremiah Wright, don't demonize venture capital, right? Someone who has fused this appeal against racism and in favor of identity politics in a way that I respect with a kind of neoliberal market capitalism that we should be opposed to.
And by the way, Jeremy Wright presumably would demonize venture capital. But anyway,
I think Jeremiah Wright would absolutely demonize venture capital, right? And so the problem is not identity politics as such. The problem is that identity politics becomes a smokescreen where you say, you know, for example, Hillary Clinton's speeches to Wall Street. I think that there are bigger scandals in the world. I also think it is exactly the wrong message to be sending to the country in this day and age that you go and you make all this money on Wall Street. Even if it's defensible in some sort of theoretical sense, don't do it because the optics are bad. Unfortunately, what happened was Hillary Clinton's speeches were defended not by people saying, well, it's right on the merits that she'd be taking all this money from Wall Street, but by people saying, well, you're a sexist if you criticize her. And it's that dynamic. It's the way that genuine left-wing alternatives are rendered toxic by this repeated association of them with racism and sexism, etc., by self-interested liberals, in my opinion. That's the problem.
So is part of the dynamic that for somebody like Hillary or Bill Clinton, their thinking runs, you know, we need money, we're getting money from Wall Street, and we can do that and still have a coalition so long as we can get the black and Latino vote, kind of. That's kind of the logic.
Right. The problem with that is that rich people are people who are used to getting something for their money, right? And this, I mean, this idea that, like, we can take Wall Street's money and not give them anything, I think is, I mean, we have not seen that, right? I bought into, for all of my critiques of the Democrats, I bought into the Barack Obama 2008 campaign. I thought that when he said that this was a transformational time, it was a new kind of politics, I wanted to believe him. Then he went ahead and the people that he picked, he hand-selected to solve the mess on Wall Street, were guys like Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers. In other words, guys who had helped to make the mess on Wall Street, right? They have to prove to us that they can actually do this, like be cozy with Wall Street people and lead a populist party. I just don't think that that's going to be possible. You know, I mean, after his presidency, Harry Truman answered phones at his own presidential library, right? Like, you don't actually have to go out and do the $400,000 speech that Obama did or is doing. You don't have to do that. I mean, especially after you sign like a $50 million book deal. There are alternatives to being cozy with financiers, but I think this really is the battle within the Democratic Party right now. Can you be an authentically left of center, at least, alternative and be the party of Wall Street? And if you look at how the donations have gone, you can track the donations from the 1% and donations from institutions that represent the interests of the wealthy. And there's been a major shift from the Republicans to the Democrats. My opinion and the opinion of people like me is that that is always going to constrain what we can meaningfully do to change the economy. And that's bad.
So at a minimum, I mean, leaving aside the question of whether you're technically socialist, which you should feel free to address, but at a minimum, you would like to see radically higher taxes on affluent people and the money used to fund radically more in the way of social welfare programs. And you think the existing liberal coalition prevents that?
Yeah. So, I mean, as a socialist, I believe that we should be moving more and more aspects of human life out of the market mechanism, right? So reversing the tide of neoliberalism, which is, for example, is in the process of trying to move public education into a market model. We want to do the opposite. So healthcare is a perfect example. Like many people, I support single-payer health insurance because I think a market model cannot provide us with a moral and functioning healthcare system. So I want to remove healthcare outcomes from the market. Education, I think that college education should be paid for by the federal government through taxation. And I think that's something that should be taken out of the market mechanism. In the long term, that involves things like nationalization of the banking industry, et cetera. But that's more theoretical at this point. But yeah.
Do you acknowledge the point that was, I guess, central to, well, neoliberalism, of course, has come to have two meanings. But let's just say the point that was probably central to the people who consider themselves the new Democrats in the 90s, which is that there are problems that are not well handled by markets, but ultimately the source of the wealth that lets you address the problems is the markets. That was the view of the New Democrats. It was the view of the neoliberals in the, I think, now largely forgotten sense of an attitude toward domestic politics and policy. But do you think there's something do you differ, you know, kind of in degree or in kind with that view?
I think that I'm not sure if I would say that degree in either degree or kind. I think that you have to look at the continuing development and technological process of the human species, right? What one farmer can do now in terms of the amount of food that he can produce compared to even a farmer from 20 years ago is staggering. We are on the cusp of this incredible AI revolution where a really vast number of things that are ordinarily taken care of by humans are going to be able to be taken care of by computers. That should be just a good thing, right? Like, if we're really about to see this AI revolution, a healthy species and a functioning society would say, hooray, this is amazing. All this work is going to get taken off of our hands. And yet it has the potential to be incredibly tragic, right? Because in the system as it functions now, that taking all these things and putting them into the hands of the computers is going to mean the demise of jobs. So look at the job of driver, right? I mean, whatever else your thoughts are on the general progress of automation and what it does to jobs, the job of driver will not exist in 30 years. It won't, right? I mean, nobody is going to be paying truckers when Tesla is going to be giving them these fully automated trucks that can go all night, that don't get into accidents, that, you know, and the driver has been a job that has traditionally provided, whether it's a taxi driver or a truck driver or whatever, a at least decent middle class income without a college education. That's going away. We need to harvest these gains and this technology for the good of everyone. Right now, technological progress is going to the very small number of people who are invested in Facebook or Google or Apple, right? The world is changing. Our technological capacity is changing. But what that's resulting in right now is immiseration. It should be resulting in a improvement of living standards for all people. It's entirely possible that we do that.
That's where disagreement enters in, of course. I mean, some people would say, well, once you take into account incentive effects, no, if you take a lot of money away from the people who are earning and redistribute it, you will just have so much smaller a pie. You know, that's the traditional argument, right?
You use the internet a lot, Bob?
What do you mean?
The idea that like people only do things and like create value under specifically monetary incentive, I think, is entirely disproven by the internet, right? I mean, I guess in some sense, like people might get some sort of like eventual monetary value from many of the things that they do. But, you know, people on the internet program games for free. They make tons of videos for free. They record podcasts for free. They, you know, like a friend of mine was dissatisfied with all the plans he could find for.
But you have to put food on the table. I mean,
you have to put food on the table. But again, my point is that once you remove people's constraints of having to work 40 hours a week, right, you are giving them the opportunity to engage in all kinds of human flourishing, which then are removed from the market, right? And again,
that seems to me the answer to the question, is a universal basic income really a good thing? Because there is the counter argument to that. Damon Linker wrote a piece a few weeks ago saying, no, you have to understand work isn't just about making money. It's about giving people meaning. So the idea of just handing out people money for doing nothing is a bad idea. And you've just addressed that question. In other words, if we just give money to people, will they just waste away, get depressed, become drug addicts, etc.? And I think you're saying the internet says no, they'll do interesting stuff. But there is the separate question of like, who's going to be doing the work that makes all the money that gets redistributed? And I guess you're saying, and maybe it's right, I haven't really thought this through, but maybe you're saying like the bigger role technology plays, the less of a question that is, right? Because you just set up the machines and they do it.
I mean, the thing is, you know, maybe this is just a poor example for your side, but when you say putting food on the table, food is the absolute perfect example of needless scarcity in our society, right? We produce a vastly higher amount of food than we actually consume, right? Like food waste is through the roof. We have artificial scarcity in that side. Now, of course, you're going to have people who do things like run the sewers or whatever and do the dirty work. So, I mean, not to get too deep into the weeds, I think that we transition gradually to a system of market socialism where something like an UBI, coupled with something like with things like a nationalization of the banking industry for other reasons, gradually removes things from the market mechanism and creates a situation where more and more people work less and less hours. You don't immediately stop and say everybody's just on the government dole now, right? If you have some sort of a guarantee of a minimal income, some people will just take that minimal income and be artists or be philosophers or whatever. And yes, some people will just play Xbox all day. I mean, I would argue that the reason a lot of people take opioids
while they play Xbox, and which tragically diminishes your Xbox performance, by the way. But
well, it's not like we're not producing a lot of opioid addicts under capitalism right now, right? The point is that you'll still have people working jobs, right? The thing is that there's going to be people who won't accept the guaranteed minimum income, who want to do more, and for them, we give them the dirty job. You say, okay, you want to go into the sewer, all right? Then we'll pay you for that labor, right? The other person who right now is working some terrible, pointless office job that exists only to have a job, right? But who would really like to be making jewelry and selling it on the internet, but who can't afford to do that, who can't afford to live that way. Well, guess what? You give them the guaranteed minimum income, you give them government-provided health insurance, and they can then after that take advantage of that productivity, do that full time, and they don't have to worry that the market rewards their productivity and exactly the amounts that they need in order to live, right? And I think that you would see an incredible flourishing of human productivity. Part of the reason that people come home and they just sit on the TV all day is because they're exhausted from working 40 and 50 and 60-hour weeks, right? Once you free people from that, one of the things we talk about is not making everybody unemployed, right? One of the things we talk about is reducing the average work week to like 20 hours a week, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no reason whatsoever that we couldn't have a standard 3-day weekend, right? Every week. Doesn't that sound nice? That's completely possible under the current technological structure of this country. It is absolutely possible for everybody in this country to be working a 4-day a work week. We could achieve that if we not even that dramatically restructured our economy. It's possible right now.
Yeah. One more question on this before we move on to a slightly different topic. Is it my imagination, or are there actually two different versions of the universal basic income being floated, one kind of on the left, but one kind of on the right? I mean, I gather there's like a left-wing version where you leave intact all of the existing social welfare programs, if not indeed enrich them, and on top of that, give people an income. But I think there's kind of a right-wing, I guess libertarian version, where we strip away the social welfare and instead give people some money, and that way you've gotten rid of the paternalism that they hate, right? So I mean, this is right? Universal basic income has more than one ideological identity, right?
Right. Yeah, and so I think it's really important that I say to the viewers is that universal basic income is not remotely a universally held position on the left. In fact, it's attracted a lot of left-wing critics for macroeconomic reasons I won't try to summarize here because I'm not qualified to. Right now, one of the debates that's playing out within left-wing spaces is whether we want a universal basic income or we want a jobs guarantee. I think jobs guarantee is a little bit incoherent in some ways. But we don't have to get into that. But I mean, it's a very basic question, right? Do we want less work or do we want more? So I don't want to represent the socialist position as just necessarily in favor of universal basic income. As far as the right position goes, I mean, look, Milton Friedman famously argued that we shouldn't be means testing food stamps, right? We shouldn't be testing to see if people actually meet the income threshold, because you end up spending more money on that enforcement than you would if you just made them universal for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Who wants them? There is that side of it. I would definitely not accept a thing that says, well, we're going to switch to a universal system, but the total sort of amount of money that the government is spending on redistribution goes down. This can only work if we're actually raising the amount, because again, we've got this creation of this massive amount of wealth in the hands of a very tiny number of people, unlike anything we've ever seen before. And the basic point is to recapture that money for the good of all people.
Okay. So back to the alt-left, it seems to me that one thing, at least some people who are said to be in this alt-left thing or whatever you want to call it, have in common is that they react against the liberal, you might say, preoccupation with this whole Trump-Russia thing.
Mm.
right? Like, Glenn Greenwald, certainly, Michael Tracy. I don't know if you've been active on this front, but there's a tendency to think that liberals are overdoing it here, right? Are you on board with that?
I agree very much, yeah.
And why is that? What mistake do you think is being made?
The mistake that's being made is that the Democrats just lost an election that they should never have lost to a deranged game show host who was on video talking about his habit of sexually assaulting women. The fact that we lost, the fact that the Democrats lost, demonstrates that something has gone very, very badly with liberal messaging. If it's really essential to say, the problem the Democrats face is so much deeper than Donald Trump. Even if Hillary had won the Electoral College, right? Since 2010, Democrats have lost more than 1,000 legislative seats at the state and the national level, more than 1,000. The state apparatus of Democratic politicians, Republicans control something like 34 or 35 of the state legislatures now. They control something like 33 or 34 of the governor's seats. Our ability to win the House of Representatives has been completely decimated. The Democrats, as Matt Iglesias said, of all people, are a smoking pile of rubble. The longer that they engage in conspiracism, the longer that they fixate on Putin, is more time that they're not addressing these fundamental issues with the party. The Democrats have to come up with a platform that means something to people. They have to go back to figuring out how can we try to appeal to all kinds of people in all 50 states and try to win back the control of this country. And every minute that they spend fixating on Russia is time that they're not addressing that problem.
Okay. And I think Glenn Greenwald and others have additional kinds of issues, right? Like traditionally liberals have been, people on the left have been rightly skeptical of leaks coming from the intelligence apparatus of the United States, and have been rightly skeptical of demonizing people by virtue of their association with menacing foreigners and so on, right? I mean, there's a couple of kind of tropes that I think they would say are being used hypocritically now.
And it also remains the fact that there is absolutely no verified, credible evidence of any intentional collusion between the Putin government and the Trump campaign. Like the fact that to this day, we don't have one piece of verified, credible evidence that actually happened.
Yeah, I kind of think the collusion thing will not pan out, at least in terms of evidence, except possibly with people who were never part of the administration per se, like Paul Manafort. And I kind of think what Trump has to worry about, and this may be what he's worried about and why he fired Comey, is that if you delve deeply into his financial history and probably into the financial history of his son-in-law, you're going to find some very interesting stuff. I mean, the guy has been playing fast and loose forever, and he's clearly been getting money from, mobsters and stuff. Which isn't a crime by itself, but I just mean when those people are your investors, there may be issues.
Look, I have no doubt that that the Russian government and Russian intelligence agencies tried to manipulate the American election in some way or the other. That is, unfortunately, an absolutely sort of banal piece of sort of what espionage agencies do. I know that because I live in the United States, and no country has more successfully and more repeatedly influenced the elections of other countries than the United States, including when we did it when we were able to rescue Boris Yeltsin just a couple decades ago. I think that, the question for Democrats is, why was your candidate so weak and so vulnerable that you were unable to prevent this manipulation from impacting the outcome of the election?
So let me ask you a kind of related question. Do you think, like, on balance, the right is any more deranged than the part of the left that you criticize?
Yes.
You do. Okay.
I think they're significantly more deranged.
In what ways?
Way more deranged.
In what ways? Because I think some of the, like when you watch the Russia thing play out, in my view, you do see some overreaction on the left, or at least some failure to just calmly and soberly assess the actual evidence as it stands and not overstate it. Yeah. And so I kind of think you know, fake news is to some extent a problem on both sides, and it's attributable to kind of standard human cognitive biases of kind of having a tribal identity, an ideological identity, and viewing things through that prism and wanting certain stories to be true, and those stories making you feel so good emotionally that you click share and you spread the fake news and or slanted news or whatever. So I actually see some commonalities on left and right. And just, I mean, these are human, they're parts of human nature. Naturally, you would find them. But I take it you're saying, no, the right is worse.
The right is worse. I mean, look, like I think that if you look at like some of the more out there and deranged sort of people to talk about Russia on the Democratic side, like Louise Mensch or Eric Garland or some of these other people who have become Twitter all-stars by just advancing the most outlandish theories. Yeah, that's completely crazy. The right has built an infrastructure to deliberately obfuscate the truth from their base. They have built this vast media and political and policy apparatus that has as its core function to constantly whip up very vulnerable and frightened people in this country into a constant state of paranoia and lunacy. I mean, I have been spending my entire adult life talking about all the problems with Democrats. The American conservative movement has created a horrific monster of misinformation that has very effectively turned many, 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 mostly older Americans into almost a parody of paranoid lunatics. And it's incredibly disturbing and sad what's happened with them. And they're absolutely far worse.
Okay. So back briefly to this internet thing and kind of you know, the way it has helped you become a voice in a way that might not have been possible 30 years ago. I noticed you're doing stuff on Medium, right? Mm. That is your, and I know that like what, a couple of months ago or something, your blog archives got wiped out or something?
Yeah. So, so a couple things. So I had a blog that I had going at my own website, frederickdebord.com, for a long time. And I kind of got sick of it. I was a little tired of writing about sort of general political blogging. I didn't really feel invested in the project anymore. And I was constantly kind of thinking about giving it up and then not. And then that blog got hacked and it got malware injected into it. It's not clear if that was just someone taking advantage of a vulnerability in WordPress or if they were going after me. But what happened was the hosting company said, you know, we're going to kill this site, but you can download this archive.
This was Bluehost?
This was Bluehost.
I've had issues with Bluehost myself in a different way, but go ahead.
It was kind of Kafka-esque because I was like, well, let me get in there and get rid of this malware. And they said, well, in order to do that, we would have to turn your site back on and then we'd be hosting a site with malware, so we can't do it. So, but it was actually kind of freeing, and I said, well, this is a great opportunity to start something new. So I have started a new blog, an education policy blog and research blog called the Innova, because that is my area of actual expertise, educational assessment.
Now, is that the thing research. That's on Medium?
No, that's still right. At frederickdebord.com. And that's got, okay. You know, okay. I set up a Patreon for that, and I'm getting like $400 a month, and I got about 100 people contributing. And it's a small project, a niche project, but I've built kind of like I really enjoy doing it, and I've built a little community. But then I was not politically writing. I have a reader who has been engaging with me and emailing me since at least 2010, and she asked me if I would write about politics on the Innova, and I said I wouldn't because I wanted to keep the project very tightly focused on education. And she offered to pay me if I would post a few things on Medium a month.
And I said, wait, where did you find this person? How can I meet people like this?
So this is like kind of, I mean, it's not a lot of money by any means, but
this is just a fan?
This is someone who has supported me financially for years. Yeah, so I mean, I have always been supported. I mean, I occasionally get a piece in a fancy magazine or newspaper, but I value my independence. Now with Patreon, I have that set up sort of automatically where people are paying me this money every month. But this is someone who really liked my political writing and had the wherewithal to offer me not a lot of money, but a couple $100 a month to write about politics sometime. Hmm.
And so that's what you're doing on Medium.
Yeah, just Medium is just an easy way to do it and to keep it separate from my life on my site, which is, you know, again, like, I mean, my profession now is in educational research and educational assessment, and I have a PhD in a related area. And so that was an attempt to sort of assert my professional identity onto my professional website.
Okay. So, and I notice, I mean, you've got, you know, like 5,000 followers on Medium. So you're getting a little pickup there, right? I mean, I'm kind of curious about how well Medium can work for someone, because it's certainly appealing to just have no editor at all. And I've had situations like that. Like, I blogged for The Atlantic like 5 years ago for a year, and that was the policy. We just posted our stuff straight to the internet.
Right.
And I really liked it. On the other hand, you did, in a sense, have overseers. You knew they were paying you money, and you knew they were reading what you wrote. So right. There was that form of liberation was lacking. The form, of course, you've got a patron, so maybe that, who knows, has constraints. But the point is, if one just wrote without remuneration for Medium and didn't have to worry about an editor in any sense of the word, I can see the appeal of that, if you could pull it off financially. And it looks like a person can build up a following on Medium. I mean, I guess you have to have some kind of pre-existing following on Twitter or something, right, to leverage. But
I mean, again, like, I've been doing this since 2008. Mm-hmm. My first blog was on Blogger, and then, you know, and I have my one going on WordPress. I mostly chose Medium because it was sort of like, it was simple, and like, I thought it was a kind of elegant interface. But yeah, it was more just about having a space that I would just kind of keep separate from that other identity. I think it's still possible to build a following in that way. I think Patreon has opened up a lot of people to being able to, I mean, Chapo Trap House makes like $60,000 a month off Patreon now.
That's what I'm told.
But I think that that's possible. It's harder now. It's not as easy to break in as it was when I started. But yeah, it's, you know, a lot of this is kind of related to my near pathological need to write. I write 20,000 words a week or more. If I'm going to do it, whether it's on in a Word doc or on the internet, and I might as well, you know, have an audience when I do it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you have to be self-motivated and you have to be self-disciplined. I'm lucky in that I can write pretty clean. I don't need a lot of editing. Well, I don't need a lot of copy editing, depending on who you ask. But yeah, you have to have a kind of a specific kind of mentality to want to go through with it that way.
Mm-hmm. And by the way,
I recommend to the young writers living at home, okay, get a few things out there. If you can write for a few times, that's fine. But build a little portfolio and then go hunting for staff writer jobs at places in New York or Los Angeles or D.C. Because then you'll get health insurance and you'll have to go into an office every day. But that stability is – you don't want the freelancing lifestyle.
No. Plus, it's just good to have some place to go other than where you live.
That's true.
So as for your other, your blog, which focuses on, you know, like education stuff, I guess that kind of leads us to the question you had wanted to discuss about IQ. Not that I'm an expert. I've written about psychology and kind of other senses. I mean, and I did write when I was at the New Republic, and the editor in the New Republic chose to publish an excerpt from Charles Murray's book, The Bell Curve. Several of us wrote in opposition to that decision, and I talked a little bit about issues of that Murray addressed, like heritability. So if I can remember that stuff from like however many years ago that was, maybe I have something to contribute. But in any event, what is your – you? I guess you wrote something about IQ and took some heat over it, and that is what you want to discuss?
Yeah, so but it's also – I mean, so the position that I voiced in those two blog posts, which we can link to, was then pretty much almost the exact same position was sort of made by three psychology professors in an article for Vox, which we can also link to, and which was kind of validating for me. So let me lay it out like this. So there is, as people know, what I would call a straightforwardly kind of racist argument, what I tend to call pseudoscientific racism, what its adherents call race realism, or they often like to talk about human biodiversity. And that basic idea is that race is real, so that things like, you know, a black person or a Hispanic person, Asian person, that these are designators that carry with them real kind of real world value. And that there are consistent and significant differences in intelligence between those groups. And that they say, so a black American, they say, is a standard deviation IQ below that of a white American, for example. Like a lot of people.
And that the basis of that is genetic difference. Right, that's the key part of their argument.
Exactly. So these are genetic differences that are sort of encoded in the genome, and so there's limited degree to which they're subject to intervention to change. Like a lot of people, I hope most decent people, I reject that argument, which isn't very brave of me. But I think that is incorrect for a variety of reasons, the most important of which being that I don't think that races are real in the sense that race realists or whatever you want to call them do. I think that our concept of race is a set of sort of social and cultural expectations that we impose upon these tendencies of shared recent heritage, right? So that, for example, if you look at the average Black American, right, is often called an African American, but in fact, if you investigate their genome, you tend to find that the average Black American is something like 35% white, something like that, or at least 35% recent European heritage, right, which is a better way to say it. All of these assumptions about recent heritage that are bound up in the idea of race don't have real strict kind of connection to genetic ancestry. So if you look at the concept of Asian, right, it makes no sense at all to me that someone who is the child of Cambodian refugees who came to the United States in 1970 share something with someone whose family has lived in the northeast quarter of Pakistan for the past 5,000 years, right? Like the connection between them seems to me to be entirely artificial, and yet they both would select Asian underneath the census designations, right? Now, that has tended to create the sort of concept of the sort of genetic racist on the right. What that has been met with, unfortunately, on the left is what I would call liberal blank slateism, which is, if the other side says that race is real and that there are these genetic intelligence differences, we're going to deny that there's any impact of genes on intelligence. And the problem with that is that it's not true. That, in fact, the fact that intelligence is highly, although not at all entirely, heritable, meaning that genetics do influence your academic ability, your IQ, whatever you want to call it, is one of the most replicated research findings in the history of experimental psychology. It has been replicated over and over and over again. So how do we know? Things like, for example, biological children are far more like their biological parents than adopted children are like their adopted parents. Adopted siblings, so siblings who don't share any genetic material, are no more alike in their IQ or not much more alike in their IQ and things like that than complete strangers. Identical twins who are reared in incredibly different conditions tend to have very similar IQs.
I think of the three, those are probably the most rigorous, although limited in their, I mean, the logic is the clearest in that third kind of experiment, I think, is the most airtight, although still limited in its application, I think. Right. But anyway, go ahead. I mean, for example, the fact that you can imagine all kinds of ways that adopted children are treated differently by their parents than biological children. And that could account for all kinds of things. And their pre-adoption histories exert an influence and so on. So that's kind of a complication. But anyway, the twin studies, they're kind of the classic heritability study. You find identical twins that presumably have identical genes in at least some sense, and so you infer that any difference in IQ is due to environment.
And look, and I'll be the first to say that these things are complicated. There's lots of criticisms of twin studies that you can look up. Mm-hmm. It's important to say that heritability does not imply unchangeability. Now, I happen to think that academic outcomes are less plastic, less changeable than we think, but that doesn't mean that they're completely unchangeable, so we have to be careful about that, and I encourage people to look this stuff up. We're now getting what are called genome-wide association studies, which are ways of looking at, now that we have very cheap gene and fast gene sequencing, we can look at scale and very large collections of data about people's genomes and start to associate different parts of the genomes with things like IQ. And we are more and more finding that there are significant interactions between these genes and the academic and intellectual outcomes that we see in people. Now, it's important to say the effect sizes of individual genes are tiny because intelligence is a polygenic trait, meaning that lots of different genes make it up.
Very, very, very polygenic, yeah.
But the basic point is that the consensus, the scientific consensus, doesn't mean it's necessarily true, but the scientific consensus is that there is a strong genetic aspect to intelligence. What I've been trying to tell people is that that does not imply, for the reasons I've already said, a racist reading, right? In other words, when we talk about genetics and heritability, we're talking about parentage, right? The genetic relationship between a parent and child, between a fraternal twin and a fraternal twin, or between monozygotic twins or whatever, these things are things that we understand very well, and the relationships are very tight and very tidy and very easy to understand. We know how genetic information is passed down between parent and child. The genetic relationship between two people of the same race is not at all the same. Right, because race again is a social construct that we've applied onto these real sort of shared recent heritage. And so what myself and people like Paige Harden, who is a psychology professor, I want to say University of Texas at Austin, I'm not sure if that's true, Eric Turkheimer, who is a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, we've been saying those are not the two alternatives, that in fact there is such a thing as being part of the left that believes in the heritability of psychological traits like intelligence, mm-hmm. And that completely rejects the sort of racist pseudoscience that's become so popular on the right.
Yeah.
And this matters because if we don't start to stake out these alternative positions, if we're not honest about what the science says and don't sort of fight to control the field of ideas, then the right is just going to fill this space. The more and more of these genome-wide association studies we do, and more information that we have, is the more vulnerable we're going to be if we're just sticking our fingers in our ears and saying this isn't real.
Yeah, the I don't have a whole lot to add. First of all, the twin studies, and I'm not up on very recent literature, but the twin studies, the numbers they come up with for heritability, first of all, just by definition, do not apply to the question of differences between races.
Right.
And you just cannot make that application. The other thing is that heritability is a really kind of elusive, it's a weird concept. Like, people think, like, you get a percentage number, like a point, you know, like 43% heritable for a trait is the way they would put it. Right. But first of all, again, if you get that from twin studies, it doesn't apply beyond the studies. It doesn't let you take any two people, much less any two people of different races, and say, well, the observed difference in IQ is 43% due to gene. It just doesn't work like that. And one kind of weird thing that a lot of people don't appreciate about heritability is, like, it's even within its legitimate realm of application, it's not like a fixed number. Like, if you equalize environments, it changes. And here's something that might surprise people at first, which will just show that they haven't thought about this weird concept much, but if you equalize environments a lot, like start sending kids to the same schools, where, say, previously two twins or two other people had gone to different schools, one good, one bad, the more you, as you standardize environment, what happens with heritability is the number actually rises, okay? Mm-hmm. Because by definition, if two people's environments were exactly the same, if you got it all the way and you said, well, then what percentage of the difference in IQ is attributable to environment? Well, it has to be zero if the environments are the same, and then so heritability would be 100%. Now, the fact is, even then, as a practical matter, it wouldn't be the case that the part due to environment was zero, because I mean, there is such a thing as non-shared environment. You've probably gotten into this, right? And this is a weird thing, too. So it's like they might say, well, two kids in the same family, you know, they have very different, IQs, and yet their environments were the same. Well, no, their environments aren't the same. He's the little brother, and he's the big brother. And that's radically different right there. And, like, they go to the same school, but they have very different experiences and so on. So all I'm going to say is it's all very elusive and hard to pin down. There's also the question that you had originally asked me, which is, well, wait, is IQ a valid concept in the first place, this idea of general intelligence? Mm. And there I'd say it's actually not a very good reflection of what intelligence actually is. In fact, the part of psychology I've written most about, evolutionary psychology, most evolutionary psychologists would say, you know, the mind is, they call it modular. I mean, it's like it has all of these different, it's like a Swiss Army knife that does a lot of different intellectual tasks. It's not like a general purpose computer. And you just say, well, how powerful is that computer? It does a lot of different tasks. And people can be good. Like when I tested in high school, I was way below average on spatial relations, which is the ability to look at, I mean, the test was you look at these two-dimensional depictions of things and then pick which of four renderings of like a carton that they could be folded into is the one they could actually be folded into. I'm terrible at that. Mm. I'm good at other things. It's like, so that doesn't mean IQ has no validity. It is of some predictive value. If you're going to try to predict how well someone does in college, you're better off knowing IQ than having no information.
It's true.
So it's not analytically vapid, you know, or devoid of emphasis, but it's not very reflective of intelligence, much less achievement.
Right. So, I mean, look, I often feel like I have to sort of navigate between these poles here, right? Because, again, we are caught so much in this sort of genetics explains nothing or genetics explains everything kind of binary. We live in a world of variability. If, like you say, if we do a study and we find that genes sort of predict 50% of the variability in someone's intelligence, that of course doesn't mean that everyone is walking around with exactly 50% of their IQ explained by their parents' IQ. There's variability in that number. It's the sort of the nature of sampling. IQ is, I think, a powerful but limited metric, which I'll say is that IQ has predictive validity for the things that it is intended to predict. So if you take a kid at 7 years old and give them an IQ test that's been validated, that will give us a pretty strong clue about how well they're likely to do in algebra class when they're 14 years old. Mm. Is that a prophecy? No, because we live in a world of variability. There's going to be kids who overperform their IQ that they got seven years old. There's going to be kids who underperform it. Is it actually a pretty strong predictor for the social sciences? Yeah. But then, of course, there's all sorts of things that IQ is not intending to measure. Whether or not you're likely to be a chess champion is something that tends to be pretty well predictable by IQ. And we can imagine why, because it's a sort of got a kind of like raw abstract processing power. Whether you're someone who's going to be a good used car salesman because you know how to schmooze and you know how to read somebody and you're good at reading social cues and you're good at getting in somebody's head, that's just not something that IQ.
But by the way, I would be a bad chess player precisely because I'm not that good at visualizing these theoretical spatial relationships far into the future as good chess players can do.
I mean, I'd say to people all the time, you know, like, what was Otis Redding's IQ? You know, the answer is, who gives a shit, right? Like, he was good at something that's very rare. He had an incredibly rare talent at something that really matters that is not IQ predictable. And unfortunately, when you get into these debates online, these I call them the G-men because G is stands for general intelligence, you know, and they want to act as though G predicts everything that matters, mostly because they all think that they have high IQs themselves. But there are all sorts of ways that humans can contribute to human flourishing that matter that are not based on this sort of raw abstract processing. And I will say, let me say a point that I've made before. The jobs that are going to be automated out, the tasks that are most likely to be taken over by computers, are precisely the tasks that are most sort of dependent on raw processing power, mm-hmm. right? I don't care what your IQ is. You're not going to be a better chess player than Deep Blue, the IBM's chess playing computer, because computers are better at that than we are. As we move forward into a more and more automated future, it seems very likely to me that the jobs that are going to be the skills are going to matter most are going to be those soft skills that are least predictable by IQ. Mm-hmm. That all that being said, right, we have to be honest and say not everyone has the exact same chance of being a Nobel Prize physicist. That is not true. And that kind of blank slate ideal, I think, leads into some destructive places for liberalism.
Okay, so we have come full circle because we're talking about liberalism again, and we've been doing this exactly an hour, 59 minutes and 58 seconds. So that's when we generally sign off. So thank you, Freddie. Where can people find your stuff? We basically mentioned, so FreddieDeVore.com has been resurrected as an education thing?
So Frederick, FREDRIKDEBOER.com, although if you just Google Freddie DeBoer, you'll find it. Yeah, it's called The Innova. It's at The Innova blog on Twitter. I'm having a lot of fun. It's like a lot of times it's me going through like a recent study and pulling out the ideas and talking about stats in a way that's accessible to popular audience, talking about ed policy, ed politics, stuff like that. I'm really enjoying it a lot.
Okay. And then you're on Twitter, right?
I'm on Twitter.
At?
Freddie DeBoer.
Who would have guessed? Okay. So people should run and find you. And I hope you'll come back and talk in the future.
I will.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bob.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.